comes more of how you use your.
We've been here, we've been hearing like.
Business.
Good morning.
A phone list of people we can.
I'm opening this meeting, Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. This is Monday, April 27th. This is an informational meeting on mobile crisis services. We have scheduled this informational hearing because this topic is one of the key factors in trying to rethink how we're providing services. We've been talking a lot about funding for mental health services, whether it's the human services side or Oregon Health Authority. And this is one of the specific topics that we've identified we should look into a little more. We have some local agencies that are doing some very good creative work in addressing the needs in a little bit different way than the standard business as usual. With that, Ms. Martin. Ms. Ames, you want to tell us who's going to be speaking?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, today AMH, Pam Martin, will give a very brief introduction, and then we'll hear from the folks at Marion County as well as Whitebird Clinic in Eugene. Or we hope we'll hear from Whitebird Clinic in Eugene.
So for the record, my name is Pam Martin, and I'm the director of the Addictions and Mental Health Services. And it's our understanding that CAHOOTS is on their way from Eugene, and we'll be speaking a little bit later. And, of course, Sheriff Meyer and Anne Marie are here. So, and as Linda said, I just want to provide the most brief introduction about this area. Mobile crisis is a service where people go out and find people where they are, under a bridge or maybe in an emergency room in their home, in their car, at McDonald's. And that's the wonderful thing, because it doesn't wait for a crisis to escalate. It puts out small fires while they're small before they get big, diverting people from the criminal justice system and connecting people to services in the best possible way. We have seen some opportunities to reduce the number of aid and assist referrals to the state hospital. And even more importantly, mobile crisis services can solve a problem while it's still small, keep people in their community with their set of their support services, and limit the disruption of people. So all communities have some first responder services. So what mobile crisis has done in general is to build on the community services in a very organic way. So when last biennium, $7 million was appropriated to put into the crisis services, this was not putting money into brand new systems. I think you'll hear from Sheriff Meyer and from the CAHOOTS folks and I've heard from Yamhill County and talked to the people and visited in Washington County that there was already a system in place. But what we asked these communities to do is tell us what the next step you need. Tell us what additional FTE or staff would make what you're doing even better. Tell us what you need in terms of expanding services, say, from Eugene and now into Springfield. So those were the requests that we put out, and communities got back to us and told us how they were going to use services, how they were going to specifically plug funding into particular areas to make their services and their system just that much better. So I think that's what you'll hear today. So there was over $7 million put into these programs, and we built our request for proposal from a particular evidence base of community-based comprehensive psychiatric services, crisis response service. And this came from the Technical Assistance Collaborative, which is a think tank group that are used for a lot of areas like jail diversion and mobile crisis in terms of putting out monographs to help communities and help states decide what array of services to put in. There were 12 community programs who serve 18 counties who are funded. They're quite varied because they spring from what's already present in a community, and it might be that they wanted to extend their hours from 4 in the afternoon to 8 to 4 in the afternoon to 11 at night or 1 at night, or it might be that they needed to add key staff. Everybody did it differently. Whoops. And so with that, I would be glad to answer any questions and get as quickly as possible to the actual people doing this work. Okay.
Yep.
Sheriff Meyer and Amory.
Senator Bates.
Yeah, Pam, thanks for coming. Come on up. So could you answer a couple questions offline for me as while I'm sitting here? I'm thinking of this. And knowing that I was very concerned about how we put money into mental health and drug and alcohol last time with no real plan for spending other than just throwing it out of various counties and hoping it did some good, which it probably did, but I was very concerned that just throwing it out there wouldn't get us where we wanted to get. You know, and when you see what's going on in the state hospital, I think I could say I probably was right. I'd like to know a couple things. One, and not now, but give it to me later. Which counties got the $7 million and where it went in any of those counties? Just, you know, which counties got the money and how you decided to spend the money in whichever counties? You know, was it a request for a proposal? Was it grants? Whatever it was. And do you know of any best practices in the United States? Is there any programs that show best practices of where they can show specific outcomes doing a great job that we want to consider for our state? The idea that everyone's going to figure it out in their own county on their own, I think, is a false premise. I think we need to have a uniform system across the state. So I'm very concerned about the hodgepodge system. So best practice would be important. And not just best practices, but what they're doing out there as far as what real outcomes are. And I would like to know what those are, too. And the last thing is, Senator Brzozinski and I looked very carefully at some of this when we were doing state hospital. There is a place in ORS where courts can supervise people on an outpatient basis and tell them if you don't take your medications or you don't go to your meetings that something else is going to happen to you. And in fact, it's in the new gun bill. And when you're under that supervision, you're potentially going to be in a situation where you can't have, or you'll be in the background check for the first time. So I'd like to know if you're using and utilizing that, if anyone's utilizing it on a regular basis. I'll give you an example of what I'm worried about. We have a mentally ill man in Ashland who a couple years ago, in the middle of a very, very hot day with wind blowing, it was 101 degrees, decided to start a fire because he felt cold. He's mentally ill. Burned down 7 houses in about 25 minutes. A very nice section of town. And luckily nobody got killed. 6 months later, he was back out in the street wandering around confused again. And people were concerned. And he's not a real immediate danger to himself and others just out there. I mean, that kind of stuff happening makes me realize we don't have a functioning, really functioning system. So, or who got the money? Are there any best practices? Are we using court supervision? If you can get back to me later about that, I'd really appreciate it.
Absolutely, we'll do that.
Thanks, Pam.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I can give you the list of the counties now. Would that be helpful to hear?
I want the counties and the money spent, how much each one of them got.
You would like to have that right now?
No.
Oh,
later,
okay.
Later. I don't take people's time.
Okay.
We got a lot of time.
Yes, Senator. Can I just build on what Senator Bates asked for? Because I'm with him about all of that. And I agree. I think we ought to standardize things as much as possible, recognizing that each of our counties has slightly different circumstances. So I'd be really interested to know, under a best and both best case scenario and reasonable case scenario, what it would cost us to implement good practices, if not best practices, in as many counties as possible, and what that might save us both in terms of human dignity and human potential and
actual hospital time and jail costs, because I think all of those are significant in the long term. So I think we have to recognize how investing in these kinds of services up front not only is good for our people, but is good for our budget. Because I think it's pretty clear from the Marion County experience that that's true. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Myers.
Morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff, and seated next to me is...
Good morning. I'm Ann Marie Banfield, Program Supervisor for Acute and Forensic Behavioral Health with Marion County Health Department.
So we're going to give you an overview of the system that we have in Marion County, and we're going to talk about mobile crisis. It really helped supercharge our system and diversion of people with mental illness that had historically been going into the criminal justice system. But before we get to mobile crisis, we really need to talk about all the work that we've done over the last 20 years collaboratively in our county to address this rising population. And I begin this presentation always with, it's so important to have collaboration. The sheriff, the health director, the district attorney, county commissioners, police chiefs, all leaning in on this issue. We all have to work together, and there's no one of us that can do everything. So it takes all of us working together, and that's what we've had, a unique situation in our county where everybody has had the same thought process around keeping people with mental illness or mental health conditions out of the criminal justice system and in the community and in care where they get better services. So we're going to go back to 1995, and about this time in our county and probably across the state, we were seeing the thresholds rise when a police officer would contact somebody in the community that appeared to have a mental health related issue. The thresholds, that is, to commit them to the state hospital. And resources were not there in the community. And we were seeing more people going to jail than we were anywhere else with mental health problems. So at that time, we knew we needed to do something. We needed to have some kind of a crisis center or a resource center that we could take people that were in mental health crisis. So we developed the Psychiatric Crisis Center. I'm going to let Anne-Marie talk about it. To this day, it serves as the hub of our whole system, kind of works out of the Psychiatric Crisis Center. It's an important part of our process in connecting people with services.
So as Sheriff Myers was saying, about 20 years ago, we went through the phase where used to be people could drop folks off right at the state hospital, which meant there were a lot of people at state hospital who really didn't need to be there. So there was a change in how people entered the state hospital, having to go through the acute care system, through the hospitals. The hospitals weren't really ready for that, and we were doing crisis evaluations in the backseat of police cars, which was also just not something that could be sustained. We had a director at that time who was a bit of a visionary and went ahead and put in the money to do the crisis center. And for 5 years, we ran in the red until we were really able, between the folks that were not going in the hospital and the work that we were doing to get people reconnected in the community, really started to pay for ourselves. We are 24/7. Within a few years, we realized we needed some sort of resource that, even if you are doing evaluations, you need some place for folks to go and get support. So we created a 24/7 crisis center, respite system as well. That includes apartments in the community as well as persons who open up their spare room for somebody who's in a crisis. We've been using that system for about 18 years now, and it's been quite successful. We also have a staff of about 20 bachelor's level folks who are skills trainers who are on call around the clock that we can send into someone's home. They can monitor medication. They can provide supportive phone calls. They can get people where they need to be. They spend a lot of time in the car getting folks to emergency appointments, getting them emergency medication, or even food boxes if that's what it takes to divert the crisis at the moment. It wasn't very long before we realized we needed to be able to do emergency medication. We started out with 6 hours a week. We're now up to 28 hours a week of a crisis prescriber, and I can get somebody into my prescriber within 3 to 5 days, which is much faster than the outpatient system.
Yes, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. Are insurance providers covering this, or is this all coming out of county mental health funds?
It comes out of county general funds, it comes out of our flexible funds, and it comes out of grants that we have gotten from federal grants that we have gotten. So we have, at this point, because we're not a medical model, traditional insurance hasn't been very comfortable with us, so predominantly we serve indigent and OHP, but we will see anyone who walks in our door. We have about a 20% private insurance rate.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Bone.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anne Marie.
Anne Marie. Thank you. So you just said that your prescriber is crisis subscriber, mm-hmm. prescriber, and can get something within 3 to 5 days,
mm-hmm.
and that's faster than the system. Mm-hmm. It just seems scary to me that in the crisis situation, someone's going to have to wait 3 to 5 days to get their meds.
We have an excellent relationship with our local emergency room, and if that person needs immediate medication, we will walk down with them, get them seen, and because we have such a good relationship, we call ahead. Usually, instead of having that 2 to 3 hour wait in that process, we can usually get them in and out of the ER in less than 45 minutes.
Okay. Wow, that's good. Okay, thank you very much.
That's really cool.
And that's part of that collaboration. We've been collaborating. We actually have our building is owned by the hospital, and it's part of our collaboration and partnership is that they, as long as we are a crisis center, we have free rent.
Senator Bates.
A couple questions real quick. How many beds do you have out in the community?
10. But if I need to, I'll rent a hotel room.
Okay. And who's your prescriber?
His nurse practitioner named Michael Scholler.
That's the only person you have?
Mm-hmm. But we do have our medical director at the health department. If he's on vacation, he'll fill in for us so we don't have a big gap in service.
Okay. I just want to get a picture of the mm-hmm. of the program. You got one of the best in the state, so I'm not picking on you.
Oh, that's right.
Okay.
I just want to know more about it. Absolutely.
Okay. So it could be 3 to 5 days, 3 to 5 days before you can get the prescriber out there to the individual, though. Do you bring them back to the center to be seen, or does he go to the home?
They come into the center, but if we need to, we'll provide transportation. And if necessary, we can put them in respite and monitor them and support them until they can see the prescriber. We can also do a sit and wait, because just like any outpatient clinic, we have no-shows. And if we have somebody who really needs to see the prescriber, they can do a sit and wait the next day and be worked into the schedule.
Would you describe your program as similar to the Alameda model?
I am not familiar with the Alameda model.
Oh, okay. It sounds like it's very similar. And the patients must be selected in some way. You're keeping some in the hospital and others you're sending to the respite center?
Mm-hmm. We do a crisis evaluation. When we first started, we did less than 1,200 in a year. Last year, we did 4,200, and this year, we're on track to do over 5,000.
How long do they usually stay in the beds?
Our average length of stay is about 1.7 days.
Those are a couple days and they move them on. Where do they go to after that?
It depends. When we originally established the crisis respite program, our desire was to we actually met with people and said, how long does your crisis last? And to the last one, they said, really, it's no more than 3 days. So our model is that they get evaluated each and every day. It's a 23-hour bed. Therefore, we don't need to be licensed, which is very expensive. And we evaluate each day what's going on. Our goal is really to keep somebody invested in that crisis and working through it and learning skills so that in the future they can draw on those skills. Whenever you put someone in an institution, whether it's a hospital or a jail or any place where they're told what to do and when to do it, they will lose some daily living skills. So our goal is to keep them in the community, whether at their own home, we can go into their homes and provide support, or in our own crisis respite beds, to really help them stay connected to that crisis and invested in the outcome.
How do you follow up on the patients?
Phone calls, appointments, we go out and check on them.
After they leave the beds?
We generally do what we call a soft handoff. We do a tremendous amount of community case management, so we are connecting them to community providers. I also have, if you'll see on the bottom, the case management team. I have 3 case managers who fill the gap. So we do between 30 and 90 days of following folks and making sure we're getting them connected to outpatient services. But ultimately, people are voluntary. So if they walk away and they don't want our services, I can't force it.
Last question. How long does it take you to get information or help from Marion County Mental Health? You must have a mental health facility here, mm-hmm. patient, right?
They do.
Is it state or nonprofit?
It is state. It's county.
And how long to get somebody in there?
We actually have a system of about 8 providers in Marion County, so it depends on which provider is available, and certain providers have specialties. So if somebody has a severe and persistent mental illness, we will direct them to adult behavioral health, and they're very good about helping us get them in the door within a day or two. The other agencies are also very good about working with us, knowing that we are their crisis service.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thanks.
Okay, now let's get back to try to catch up a little bit.
Okay. So we include some photos. This was a great conversation about what the psychiatric crisis center does, but we include some photos about where it's at. It's located on the grounds of Salem Hospital. So where you see the dot, that's where the psychiatric crisis center is. The Salem Hospital Psychiatric Medicine is right across the street, and then about a block up is the emergency department. Great relationship that we share with the hospital, and as you can see, we utilize that relationship on a daily basis. That's just a view towards the ED from the Psychiatric Crisis Center, and that's what it looks like. It's, again, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I'll talk a little bit more about how law enforcement accesses these services in the presentation. So as we move forward in 2006 and 2007, we knew that we needed to do more to our system. So we opened the Psychiatric Crisis Center. It was up and running, and good things were happening there. But we were still seeing numbers increase at our jail of people with mental illness being booked. And so we made the decision to add some qualified mental health professionals at the jail. And they work out there at the jail with our jail staff. And their job is to engage with people that come into custody with a mental health crisis and then work to reintegrate them when they get released back into the community. And they're working very closely with the Psychiatric Crisis Center, as you can see, there's a lot of services that are provided there. So we have two and a half full-time positions that work out at the jail. They span 7 days a week, and they work very closely with the jail deputies. As a matter of fact, they would say they're an indispensable part of their team. So that work has gone very well. During the same time frame, we knew we needed to get something out on the front end of the system. So we made a conscious choice to offer crisis intervention training for all of our law enforcement officials here in Marion County. So we sent a couple of our folks off. The health department sent a couple of their folks off. We worked together and launched this training that we offer twice a year. It's the 40-hour Memphis model, which is a national standard. We send everybody to our office, so it's not just patrol. The jail deputies go, and the parole and probation deputies go as well. We open it up countywide, so all law enforcement in Marion County are able to go, and as well as outside of our borders. We just had our spring class. It was full. We had a waiting list for names. We had 36 people graduate from that. To date, there's about 75% of my sworn staff that's been through CIT training. I mean, my goal is 100%. But with an agency my size, with attrition, we kind of stay at about that 70-75% range. And that training will be ongoing into the future twice a year.
You mentioned all law enforcement officers in Marion County. When you used that phrase, did you mean that law enforcement officers from municipal departments like Salem or any of the other cities around here, Kaiser, would be welcome to join in?
Chair Nathanson, yes, we do, and we actually encourage it. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, but it's important to have that training because it's about identification, de-escalation, and then referrals to services. And the more that we can have our law enforcement professionals trained in this area, the better we are going to be as a community. So, yes, it's open to all those agencies, and they all send people, and they're in the process of trying to get their teams fully trained as well.
Great. So one follow-up. Perhaps someone from your local LPSC, Public Safety Coordinating Council, might have statistics on, you know, what percentage of your own officers have attended the training. It would be interesting to see what percentage of city units have.
So it runs a gamut in our county. Small agencies like state and police department, they're 100%. But they're a smaller agency, so we can follow up on that. You know, I think the goal of the chiefs meet monthly, and I go to those meetings, and they want to get to where they're 100% trained as well. So
great.
It's a goal for all of us in our county.
Thank you.
Yeah. So in 2008, we continued to kind of build on our system. I'm going to have Anne-Marie talk about the 370 aid and assist managers. So I'll have her talk about that piece to our program.
One of the things that is distinct about Marion County is we have more state institutions than any other county in the state, and it does change our population just a bit. So we have the dubious distinction of having the second highest population of 370 at the state hospital here in Salem. And in 2007, the state said we need to work on that. So they funded a case manager for us. We did see a significant drop. At that time, we had about 18 average. We saw a significant drop just after we added case management. We actually got down to about 4 for about 3 months, which was fabulous. And then a lot of training started happening in the legal system around 370 and the aid and assist process. And what we found is a lot of defense attorneys started using it as a defense tactic. And so our numbers went up significantly again. And a year ago, last fall, we were at about 28. We are now back down to about 14, and I think that's based largely on the collaborative effort that we've been doing for the last year or so. The sheriff, the district attorney, one of our circuit court judges, and somebody from each of the defense bars, we've been meeting regularly for over a year, both to do education as well as to understand kind of who is this population and how can we serve them. And our case manager will follow the person from the jail to the state hospital and back, and then offer services if once they're released.
At the same time,
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
I don't know if this is the right time to ask this question. If it's not, you can hang tight on this. Your point about the 370 cases going up and down and up and down makes me wonder a little bit more about also your emergency department. You know, you're talking about the close relationship you have with the emergency department. And I'm really interested to know how, I'm not trying to figure out the best way to articulate this question. You know, if people come to you and you get these folks in and out of the emergency department when you need to in 45 minutes, how does the percentage or the amount of time or whatever it is taken by patients who are coming into the emergency department specifically for mental health issues per population compare to other areas, you know, other hospitals with similar catchment sizes? Does that question make any sense?
It actually does, and okay. I think that each hospital is different. I know that our hospital is the busiest ER in the state simply because there are no other hospitals in the area that do the same work. Because of that, people stay, usually if they come in with a mental health issue, and predominantly if that's psychosis, they're going to probably be in our ER from anywhere from 6 to 18 hours while, one, we're treating what's going on. Part of the issue that goes on with that is we're facing about a 60 to 70% co-occurring rate with drugs and alcohol on board.
Sure.
And so most psychiatric units will not take somebody who is intoxicated at that time.
I know.
So we will do, they are working actually at our emergency room right now to create a protocol for how to manage when somebody is psychotic and testing positive for a drug. Some protocols that will allow us to treat them, see how they're doing. If it's a meth-induced psychosis, really what we need to do is get them deal with the psychosis and then get them connected to that treatment, which is, I will admit, very difficult to do. We just don't have enough A&D detox in the state. We need more. If it's a psychosis and we know them well, we can get them fairly quickly into a bed, and so they're not spending much time in the emergency room, partly because we only have 3 secure rooms for safety, and we need to get them turned over as quickly as we can for the next person who may need it.
2 quick follow-ups, if I may. The first is, you said if we know them fairly well, which brings up the question of, for want of a better term, recidivism. And I'm curious to know whether your sense is that, you talked about teaching them skills during that acute crisis they can use in the next one. Do you start to see tail-offs in how much, you know, the number of crises or the frequency of crises in people over time, or compared, have you talked with colleagues in other parts of the state or country where they're seeing people coming back because they don't have these?
I think if you went back and looked at our numbers 10 years ago or 20 years ago, what you'd see is that certain people had multiple hospitalizations because they didn't know what else to do.
Right.
When we started keeping track of the data about, I think it was about 12, 13 years ago, I would have people who would be hospitalized anywhere from 10 to 15 times in 1 year. Now, when we look at our data, if somebody's been hospitalized 4 times in a year, that's a lot. I think the difference is that we have a good idea of who people are now. We have a really good relationship with folks. We have a very good relationships with our peer services. So the peers know about us and how to use us, and we also know how to refer people to those services for support as well. At the Crisis Center, consistently, we have about a 50-50 rate. 50% of the people we see each year are first-time, one-time-only kind of visits. And then we have 50% of the people that we know. What you're really talking about with recidivism, I think differently because of the work I do. We have people who get triggered at different times in the year, whether it's from trauma or past history or delusions that come up at a certain time of year. Like, for example, Easter is a big time. Folks with religious delusions that tends to be a really big time for them. So there are certain people that, yes, I will see every year about the same time because that's what happens in the cycle of their illness. And we just handle that as offer as many supports as we can. And sometimes we're able to help them stay in the community, and sometimes they just need that tune-up at the hospital for safety. It depends on their situation. I think our recidivism has gone down considerably since we've started doing the crisis center and have all the supports that we have.
On your mention of co-occurring disorders in the psychiatric unit, if there's evidence of drug or alcohol use, mm-hmm. They're not going to take the person.
Not necessarily. What we need to do is show that we've tried to address the drug use, and if we've treated it and it's not going away, it could be that this person is now going to be dealing with a mental illness for the rest of their life, and they will take them in. But we do need to address it before we send them to the psych unit.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I ask a follow-up to that question?
And I want to make sure. I want to make sure that we're done by 9:25 to give the other presenters.
Great. And I'll make it really quick. And it may be questions because it's partly for you and it's partly for Ms. Martin. Actually, one of the concerns I've heard from colleagues is that because you're right, co-occurring disorders. I mean, we know about dual diagnosis. Mm-hmm. It's pretty common. Because people self-medicate with drugs mm-hmm. or alcohol because of underlying psychiatric illness. So the question is then, sometimes I've heard from colleagues that once a patient presents with intoxication, even if they're known to have an underlying mental health issue, they're then turfed away, and the mental health providers in the community are saying we can't treat them, but that they're not our problem because it's really a drug and alcohol problem, even if they're sober and they're still mm-hmm. having the mental health issues. Are you seeing that in your community? And
no.
No?
Okay. No. We're part of the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. They've done a tremendous amount of education around co-occurring disorders and really the philosophy that no door is the wrong door. You want wherever they're coming in the door is where you want to treat them. So we try and do both at the same time. I think there are more and less concern around how much they're using and sort of how can we wrap the supports around them that they need at that time. But I have not seen people turned away simply because they have that history, especially if they're not using at the time.
Okay. Well, I'll just say to Ms. Martin that I'm hearing that from colleagues in other parts mm-hmm. of the state, and I'd be good to get some follow-up at some point.
Mm-hmm. Senator Bates.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm going to make a suggestion if we could. Emory, you're the first person we've talked to here. It's down the trenches reviewing the job that we want done and getting some information. You have two physicians who deal with this all the time, so we're, really eager to hear more. And we don't want to take the time up with the committee. What I'd like to do is, for those who are interested in the committee, go over to your center and sit down with you
yeah.
and have a real one-on-one for a real, probably a couple hours if you can afford that kind of time.
Sure.
And really walk through the program.
Mm-hmm.
I have a million questions.
Me
I don't
too.
Want to take time up for doing this. But you're doing what we want to have done, and we just need to know what's working, not working, and what resources would make it better for you.
Sure, I'd be happy to have you come visit.
Thank you.
Yeah, count me in on that.
Thank
one,
you
please.
Very much.
Okay.
And at least one representative I know is interested in making a personal visit as well. Sheriff, please
Thank
continue.
You. So in 2008, we also established a mental health court, which is a place
yeah.
where people that are in the system can go. It's a specialty court with wraparound services. So in 2009 and 2010, we knew we needed to continue to do more on the front end of our system to divert people. And so we established a mental health task force. And what that was is we brought all of our law enforcement together in our county, all the chiefs of police, the state police, our office, the health department. And we talked about what we needed to do to better utilize the psychiatric crisis center, get more law enforcement involved in the crisis intervention training. And so out of those conversations, we drew up a memorandum of understanding that all the law enforcement executives signed that said if our folks in the field come into contact with somebody that's in a mental health crisis and it's not egregious charges, that they would utilize the psychiatric crisis center instead of the jail. And at the same time, continue this crisis intervention training. So that has worked very well. I think it started raising the numbers of individuals that were being brought to the psychiatric crisis center. And I'll show you a slide in a few minutes about our bookings, which started to go down, which was really good. At the same time, we really wanted to kind of get out in the community with a clinician and a deputy together. And we kind of got our set up backwards here. A lot of communities roll out with mobile crisis first. We started with what we called the CORT team. It's the Crisis Outreach Response Team. And this is a low-level cold contacting team with a deputy sheriff and a clinician. Deputy sheriff's in plain clothes, drives an unmarked car. They take referrals from law enforcement anywhere in our county. Of individuals that they contact in the community that appear to have a mental health crisis. It's not enough to go to the psychiatric crisis center, not enough to generate charges, but they do need some kind of assistance or follow-up. And so at that time, this team is still continues to this day in existence, and it's worked very well. We have some very good anecdotal stories, but these are really cold contacts. And the people we're contacting in the community are actually shocked. You're a police officer, you're here to help me, you're with a clinician. It's a completely different thought process for them, and it's been really good because we've actually, in some cases, we have, example, lowered the amount of 911 calls an individual is making just by connecting them to services. Again, low-level mental health issues, not high-level, but taking up a lot of resources in terms of 911 and other issues. At the same time, we got a Justice Bureau of Justice Assistant grant. We use that for funding to help people that are in crisis. I think Mentors was included with that and some other financial things we could do around housing. And so we were kind of really starting to boot our system up on the front end. But mobile crisis was really where we wanted to go. But this is what we could do with the grants that were available because there was not a lot of general fund. And so when, in 2013, when the funding came through for the mental health investments, we were well-suited with all the programs we've just talked about to really roll out our mobile crisis and have it effective because in order for mobile crisis to be effective, to engage somebody who's in the community in a mental health crisis, you really have to have those supportive services as we just talked about. If you don't have those, you can de-escalate things, but you have no handoff for that individual. That's why it was so important for us to talk about that. So I'm going to have Anne-Marie. This is really a joint venture because we have a clinician with mobile crisis with a deputy sheriff. We have a Salem police officer and a clinician. So we have two teams that work together. They work really peak hours. And she's going to kind of talk about the nuances. But we have some numbers which are very, very promising in the work that they're doing in the community. I think all, if you talk to any of the chiefs around here, they would be appreciative because if they get a call, if somebody in crisis, they can call this team, and if they're available, they're going to respond. It doesn't matter whether it's in Salem or Aurora or Jefferson or Idana. They're going to go if they're on duty, and they're going to assist that law enforcement agency or the sheriff's office with the person in crisis.
I would just say a couple of things. One, you'd think we got this backwards, where we started CORT first, and it goes through the Bureau of Justice Administration, and then we do mobile crisis, and it goes through the Oregon Health Authority. That doesn't quite seem to make sense. But on the other hand, one of the benefits to this is that when we started discussing this with our local law enforcement agencies, they are dependent on their numbers for their funding as well. And because this comes through the Oregon Health Authority, they don't have to give up their numbers in order to hand cases over to us. So that's been a really beneficial thing, and really encouraged them to partner with us. They haven't had a reason to not partner with us. The other piece of that is, as part of those grant funding opportunities, we also have a jail diversion case manager. She works both in the jail and outside the jail, and all of our teams, our jail mental health team, the mobile crisis team, the CORT team, even our 370 case manager, when one of his folks kind of slips away and isn't visible, she will go out and find them. She looks under bridges. She goes out to the mission. She goes wherever she needs to go to find someone. She pairs with the A&D mentor to go out and look and really encourage people to participate in the services that are available. And because we have that hub, we have that opportunity for somebody who can really reach out and provide those services in the community, which I think makes all the difference. And she has the support, that 24/7 support from the crisis center. So even if she's not in the office, we have a good idea of what's going on with their cases. We're able to look them up in the files and make sure that we can provide consistent services when they come in the middle of the night.
I think one of the important aspects with a clinician and a law enforcement official together is we have the criminal side that we can look at. The clinician can look at the medical side and through that work through the issue. We get both sides of the equation. Now, while they can't share the information, we're seeing both sides. And so we know what the issues are really can work towards a great solution. So the schematic really just kind of shows you that it's a system, and it's supported obviously by the strengths that we have with the psychiatric crisis center and all the resources out of it. But all of these systems kind of catch people, and ideally we want to catch them on the front end and keep them out of the criminal justice system. But if we don't, we have a catch point inside the criminal justice system to make sure that we're connecting them with services so that they don't come back. So we have a couple anecdotal stories. I'm going to flip through those real quickly and really go to the results, because that's really at the end of the day what we're all here about, right? The most important thing is we're doing the right thing for people that are in mental health crisis. But there are also savings in the criminal justice system as well. If you look at our jail bookings in 2006, we were hitting an all-time high. We were almost up to 20,000 bookings per year. By layering on all this work, the trend line is down for bookings. We're down about 5,000 bookings, and crime has remained about the same. So that's really good news, and tells you that there's less people coming in to the criminal justice system through the jail. I'll let Anne-Marie talk a little bit about court and the mental health crisis team.
One of the things we're seeing now that we've added mobile crisis is that our court outreach isn't quite as much as it used to be, but that makes sense because we're doing more work on the front end and encountering people at the moment of the crisis. They last year reviewed almost 2,350 reports, so the local law enforcement agencies send some of those reports to us, and then we go out to Salem and Kaiser and pick up the reports. And then we go out and we do these cold calls, and people about 90% of the time will not only open the door and let us in, but they'll sign the release so we can speak to one another, which seems odd, but I can just tell you Marion County has the strictest interpretation of HIPAA in the state, which makes our jobs even harder some days. One of the things that we did with that Bureau of Justice Administration grant is that we bought a database. So anybody who had signed a release or any information that comes out of a police report or is given to us in the midst with everybody present is put into that database so everyone has access to it, because I can't access the law enforcement database and they can't access my health department database. It's made a big difference in our ability to serve people, because the information is right there and available to all the teams at one time. The other piece is with mobile crisis, you can see we had 455 contacts. Only 22 were sent to jail, and half of those were because they had outstanding warrants. Folks are not going to jail with our mobile crisis team. They are either being diverted to us at the crisis center, or if need be, on a police officer custody to the hospital. They don't track those, but what they tell us is that their impression is that that the number of police officer custodies has actually gone down quite a bit because of our ability to, one, spend more time out in the field and really calm somebody down and then refer them to the crisis center.
So to kind of tag on what Anne-Marie is talking about, where are these people going? And they are going to the psychiatric crisis center. They're not going to the jail, they're not going to the emergency department. So that's good. That's a good place for them. We have the resources. We're able to work with them and connect them to the community. And as she just mentioned, the emergency department, Salem Hospital, they're seeing the police officer custody numbers go down, which is good. It means that there's more hospital beds available for true emergencies and not necessarily being taken up by the folks in mental health crisis. The Oregon State Hospital, we've seen our misdemeanor aid and assist drop by 44%. I think it on average is about 2 per month. And as I understand, that would be, I'm going to do some quick math here. It's $800 a day, right? $200,000 a year per bed. I mean, 2 beds over a year, that's decent savings there. Certainly, resources can be used for other things. You want to talk about transitional case management?
So the three programs I have, so we have BREEZE, and I had a supervisor years ago who would create the acronym and then make it work. So it stands for Brief Resource Enhancement and Support. And we have BREEZE for the folks who are recycling through the acute care system. So maybe they're making several stops at either the ED or going through the acute care system, and they're not getting any traction in the outpatient system. So we will case manage them into services. We have our jail diversion case manager, of course, and then our 370 case manager. And their role is really to capture those folks who are sort of drifting in the system and help them get connected into the right service with the right system that works for them. Because, again, we have 8 different providers, and for each of them, they have a different feel to them. So we try and help somebody find the right provider. And we've seen that caseload grow over time. We have a large number of Medicare folks on our BREEZE caseload simply because it's often difficult to find Medicare providers, but we're getting there.
And that's it for our presentation. We're happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of wonderful information. One of the things we may want to follow up a bit more on, and I know Senator Steiner Hayward has been interested in this aspect also, it's related to sharing information between law enforcement and health department agencies. So we may want to talk about that a little bit more. Thank you. I hope you can stick around for the next presenters in case there are any questions that we have that we want to ask you to come back up for.
Sure. We're happy to. Thanks.
Thank you.
And just let me know when you want to come over.
Yeah. And Marie, could you give us, I'm sorry.
We'll exchange information
you have a card?
Later.
Oh, okay.
I just
will
took
the
my
next
card
presenters
down my purse,
but I'm please my come on up.
Email address. Marie, doctor. At least they have the beginning of
Welcome to Salem.
Well, thanks for inviting us.
You just followed me up. If you came up this morning, I was just a little bit ahead of you on the road.
My name is Chuck Girard, and I'm the coordinator of White Bird Clinic.
And I'm Kate Gillespie, and I'm the CAHOOTS program coordinator.
And my name is Ben Brubaker, and I'm an administrative assistant and a crisis worker with CAHOOTS.
Ready?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to start off with a little bit of history. We go way back to 1969 when a group of community members in Eugene got together to try and address what we call the fallout of the 60s. Growing number of people on the streets, young people for the most part, not necessarily trusting mainstream systems, not getting the care that they needed. And so the group, which included doctors and nurses and graduate students at the university and counterculture people, decided to form a new organization, a grassroots effort called initially White Bird Socio-Medical Aid Station. And it was incorporated as a nonprofit in 1970. And from day one, the group, in addition to providing medical services and legal services, also provided crisis services, phone, walk-in, and mobile. And over the 45 some odd years, we haven't missed a shift. We've continued to be open for those services, among others.
And I've walked past your door many times because I worked on campus and then walked between campus and downtown.
Right.
So sometimes I would take the little extra jog to walk past your building.
It's a lively place.
Yeah.
In 1984, we had the opportunity to apply to the county, Lane County, to become the county's crisis center. And we were successful and became the crisis center for Lane County. And provided phone, mobile, walk-in, mental health information referral. In 1988, as part of the Public Safety Advisory Committee, we had an opportunity to give some input about how they were going to use some additional money that the Eugene Police Department got. And they had the opportunity to hire two additional officers. And we made a proposal that instead they hire us to provide a human service intervention response as part of the non-emergency police dispatch so that they could send police, fire, ambulance, or us. And we made a convincing enough proposal that they were persuaded and decided to give it a try. And that's when CAHOOTS was born. We opened in 1989. CAHOOTS stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets. The in-joke was, now we're in CAHOOTS with the cops. And we started 7 days, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day in service, responding to the community need. Over the subsequent years, we were expanded time and again, and eventually got to the point where we had we were 7 days, 12 hours a day, every day, nonstop. Fast forward to 2011. The city of Eugene and the police department, despite facing some cutbacks otherwise, decided to get us a second van and double our staff and let us run 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, with overlap during peak periods. So we run two units. And we continue that way in Eugene.
At 16 hours?
At 16 hours a day. Two vans doubled up during peak periods. So we're 11 a.m. to 3 a.m. Throughout the period, we kept trying to develop an expanded model and go metro. We saw a greater need there. And came close a couple times, but usually funding issues were the problem. So when the Mental Health Initiative money came out, we saw that as the opportunity to go at least into Springfield and the urban growth boundary. And so we worked with Lane County on developing the proposal. And I think they were kind of brave because we persuaded them to use the model that we had been running for 25 years, that we had great experience and were known for. And we'll talk more about that model. It's a little bit different from what initially came out in the request for a proposal. And so we put it in. We were one of the 12 programs around the state that got the grant. And we initially had to work with the state and the county to sort of explain why it was a little bit different and why it was really okay and really met the legislature's intention. And then innumerable delays with getting the outfitted rig that we use. And so it took a while to launch, but this past January, I think, we finally got on the road in Springfield and the urban growth boundary. Had to hire additional staff, obviously, and make additional arrangements with Springfield Police Department, who dispatches that side of it, the metro side, and the Lane County Sheriff's Office, who picks up some of the urban growth boundary. But we're interfaced with those three law enforcement as a responder through their systems.
And so we're comprised of a team of a crisis worker who has some sort of extensive mental health background. Most of our folks have at least 3 years of crisis intervention in some other capacity before they come onto the truck, paired with a medic partner who has their minimum of an EMTB all the way up to a paramedic or an RN. And crisis workers help to assess people and assist them if they're experiencing mental health issues, emotional disturbances, and disorientation. We provide a significant amount of counseling in the field, performing mental health evaluations, providing suicide prevention, reduction, and assessment, and determining what resource level the person needs, whether they need to go into the emergency department or be connected with county mental health or helped out with setting up an appointment with their prescriber. We also do a significant amount of grief and loss counseling in the field. Sometimes we are the folks that go in and deliver death notifications, or will come in after law enforcement has delivered a death notification and go in and help families. We can stay on scene a lot longer than police officers can. We also work with mental health and co-occurring disorders with drug and alcohol, again, assessing where people need resources and what resources are appropriate for that person. Our medics work with us. They help tease out whether somebody is experiencing true psychosis from a mental health issue or if it's delirium from some kind of infection. They also do a lot of just general medical evals. They do blood sugar testing, they do blood pressure testing, and with that, it works really beautifully together. Sometimes I'll go in with my medic partner, and somebody's been experiencing mental health issues, maybe the neighbors called in on them, and they're saying, I don't have any sort of mental health issues, but what I can do is go, well, you did say that your head's been bothering you, maybe you have a headache, and can my medic partner go ahead and give you a physical assessment? And maybe they're more willing to go that route than to have a mental health counselor evaluate them. And that kind of gives us a lead in. And so we work with each other. And I think the model works really well together. And so this is just kind of an idea of what we do. Because there's so unclear of a line between what's a mental health issue and what's a substance abuse issue, we work with all of those things. And then housing becomes an issue when people are having mental health issues, so we tie people in, getting them into the mission or trying to figure out other options for them.
And so this is just a little slide here about how we're dispatched. Basically, the phone call comes in, and then it may be appropriate for EMS or police, but then the dispatchers have now this third option that they can utilize of the mobile crisis. Occasionally, EMS or police will respond first to things and then call us in after they've decided that the scene is stable or that the person really isn't in need of their level of care. Then we'll go in, we'll just kind of talk to the individual.
I'm going to interrupt you for
sure.
A moment. So who is making the call? Are we talking about a call to 911 or a call to your number directly?
No, a call to 911. All of it's dispatched through the police non-emergency number in either Springfield or Eugene.
And you said that usually the police respond first?
No, they oftentimes send us individually. Occasionally, they will respond to a situation because it seems like it's more criminal, or EMS will go because it seems like it's more medical, and then they'll call us in to assist once they've cleared the scene or decided that it's more appropriate for our services, which just allows them to free themselves up quicker, and then we can provide the follow-up care. And so then once we're on site, again, we'll call back EMS or the police or utilize those agencies if we decide it's more appropriate for them once we're there, because the dispatchers never know for sure. But if it seems like it's something that we can handle, we may transport them. We decide maybe they do need to go to the hospital, or they do need to go to a respite or a shelter, or other human service agencies, and that's really where we kind of like limit our transports to, is we want to take you to a service of some kind that seems to like it will better your situation or help some outcome in some way. And sometimes that's as simple as giving them a ride over to where they need to get their food stamps, or giving somebody a ride over to Social Security because they really are having an issue because they haven't got their check and they need some help with that. So we try to help, you know, take people to wherever the most appropriate level of care is. Other times we're sitting with people in the field and just trying to resolve it in the field. If we decide that they really aren't appropriate for the ER, and we can talk to them and help them to make a safety contract with us to call us back if it gets worse again, if in the case of somebody who's suicidal, or a lot of times people just need to talk for a little while, and if we can help them to talk with us, get a grip on which coping skills they're going to use, and figure out a way to kind of make a plan for that day, that 24-hour period, sometimes that's as much as we can do. And then, as I was saying, occasionally we're actually kind of helping in addition as auxiliary to the existing EMS police contacts. And so in a case like domestic violence or a family dispute, occasionally we'll come out and counsel one of the parties, provide minor medical care if that's necessary. Occasionally we get called out to crime scenes or accident scenes to counsel bystanders and try to help them out. Again, we do some basic medical evaluations and help get people to the hospital where it's appropriate. A lot of times that's with a lot of our clients who are homeless and don't have any other way to get to the hospital, and we'll go out and give them a ride. And again, just kind of that finer point that what we're really trying to do is just help provide alternatives to the ER. For folks that maybe are having some kind of mental health issue but can be stabilized in the field or just need to get linked up to their existing case managers or providers. And a lot of times what we're doing is exploring with the individual to figure out what they already are linked to and get them connected back into those services.
And sometimes we're offering support for people who have ongoing counselors, but it's midnight and they're really struggling with something and just need someone to come in the home to talk with them. And so we'll go in, talk with them, and then make sure that they have a plan in place to see their counselor within the next few days.
So each CAHOOTS van responds to approximately 25 calls a day. 60% of our clients are usually homeless, although we we say that we...
That's 25 calls in a just a 16-hour period.
Yeah, 12 hours.
12 hours.
12-hour period.
That's a lot of calls.
Yeah. Yeah, and each van can handle up to that amount, but then between the two vans, at least there's that many, and now between the three, we're seeing those numbers go up more. And we also, like I was saying, we talk about how there is a definite large subset of our population that's homeless, but we serve folks that are all across every socioeconomic bracket, from the larger homes in the South Hills down into the Whitaker and some of the more lower-income areas. And then this is a breakdown of the kinds of places that we take people to and the kinds of calls that we respond to.
Well, thanks. Do TDOC and Sober, is that the Buckley Center I keep hearing about?
Yes. Yeah, there's a large number of calls that we respond to that are for intoxicated individuals, and a lot of those would normally be routed to an ER because of the level of intoxication that they're experiencing. And I'll talk about that more when we talk a little bit about ER diversion here in a second.
All right.
But no, it's definitely something that we've noted that Buckley House, which is a part of Willamette Family Treatment, is a huge reason that we're able to divert a lot of folks from the ER because we're able to take folks in there and sober. The difficulty, as they were talking about before, though, is with meth-induced psychosis, that the sobering center is really set up as one large room where a lot of different people can lay down. They screen people in, and it's really set up for alcohol and maybe like some kind of opiate drug use. Somebody that's having meth-induced psychosis, they only have two secure rooms where they can put people, and once those are full, we don't have an ability to take people there. And there are definitely some similar difficulties with the ERs locally being able to hold on to folks that are having meth-induced psychosis because they don't feel like it's a mental health issue. They don't think that they should be taking up their bed space in the ED.
Senator Bates, follow up.
I don't want to take your time, but so what do you do
with somebody that has meth-induced psychosis?
And you have your two rooms full, the ER doesn't want to take
it. We advocate for them at the ED and try to get them in and try to get them to look at the underlying issues if we feel there are some, or make a case for why they're unsafe out on the streets and why they might need to stay there for a little while if there's not another option. They've generated 5 calls already during the, 5-6 hours we've been on shift, and we've heard police and EMS already out with them. We'll sometimes take them to the ER and kind of make the case of, like, can you see if you can bring them down and look at the underlying stuff. And a big part of what we're doing a lot of times is advocating for the individuals we serve at these different agencies and trying to get them appropriate levels of care regardless if there's a co-occurring disorder or not.
Senator Steiner-Hamer.
Thank you. And again, there may be time that's more appropriate to answer this question, but I'm really fascinated listening to the two presentations this morning about similarities and differences between the two. And each program, to my eye, has a real strengths, and in some ways, each has gaps that the other one fill. And I'm thinking more and more, I just wrote a note that I was going to pass to Senator Bates, saying basically I think we need to figure out a way to sort of map or chart the ways programs in different areas are structured, really effective programs like yours and like the one in Marion County, which are very different. And, because he was saying we need to develop some kind of a model program and have some consistency, and yet here are two really good programs that seem to be having the same goals and aims but doing it in very different ways. So I don't quite know how we should go about this, but I think it warrants further conversation to compare and contrast and figure out how to leverage the strengths of each of these types of programs into the other, because you're both doing great work.
Yeah, no, and we were definitely taking notes while they were presenting about the places where they were having some really good successes. One of the things we've lost recently in Eugene is our crisis respite beds that we did have through Royal Avenue that was a part of shelter care. And Trillium, the CCO down there and shelter care decided to discontinue that program suddenly without putting anything else in place.
Really?
Which has been put a real load on the work that we do, and definitely put an extra load on the ER, because that was a successful place we could divert people to. Yeah, that's the face we made.
And what was their rationale for doing that?
Depends on who you ask.
They weren't very forthcoming about it. There was something going on behind the scenes between Trillium and shelter care. And shelter care over time began to cost more and more money relative to the funding that was available. So at some point they cut out the indigent beds and would only do insurance billing, and then couldn't do enough of that to maintain the expenses is the clearest story I heard. We're involved in some committees and work groups right now to establish a clearer sense of respite. Appropriate crisis respite, and we're looking at a model. I don't know that we're going to be able to afford all of it immediately, but there's a community committee, and we're looking at crisis respite for folks that need 5 or 10 days to either stabilize in their medicine or get through a particular difficult period. We're also looking at peer-supported respite, because one of the other programs down there, Laurel Hill, has been doing that for a while with their folks and started a collaboration this year with Lane County Behavioral Health to take some of theirs, and we want to expand that model dramatically because there's some folks that would be safe in that setting. We're also looking at a third population that is folks who have long-term severe needs and need probably 60 or 90 days and case management and a whole support system, and that's going to be obviously the most difficult and expensive one to build. We're also looking at, very active in looking at care coordination, because we have a number of wonderful agencies, but we're not really working together as a system. So that's also a conversation we're having. We're pretty active, but we do have some gaps, no question.
There's another possible explanation, or at least contributor to the decision to close that shelter. And this is one that really bugs me, and we'll have to ask Ms. Martin to help ferret this one out. There has been a suggestion that there's some sort of either a rule or an agreement, a fear that the federal government doesn't reimburse for this sort of respite housing. Mm-hmm. If alcohol, you can't pay for it from the mental health side if there was any presence of alcohol or drugs, whether it's abuse or single use or what. However, in the case of co-occurring disorders, there was a feeling that the state was saying you cannot spend the money on crisis respite for this person if there was any drug or alcohol use involved at all. And since hearing that, I have heard that other states interpret a particular federal rule in a different way and have not prohibited that use. So
that might be something we'd like to hear more about than follow up on.
And we'd like to follow up on what's going on down there.
Senator Bates.
Just real quick. This is this kind of conversation we had when we put the CCOs together. We had 40 or 50 different groups from the state having these kind of conversations, taking notes from each other, mm-hmm. exactly what happened. And the state was there taking notes, trying to find out what we could do to make things work better. I mean, closing down shelter care is crazy. It's crazy.
Right.
I mean, this is crazy.
We've got to
find a way to fund it.
Right.
Because otherwise we're going to be in jail, or we're going to be in state hospital, or they're going to be in the ED again and locked up.
Right.
So, I mean, those kind of things just shouldn't be allowed to happen, but I understand your frustration. So, you know what I wanted to do at the beginning of the session? We've not been able to do that. I think we have to do it. We're going to have group meetings on a regular basis from all over the state.
Yeah, indeed. Yep. Help get us through the rest of your slides.
Sure. So... One of the things that we do, this is a quick shot of our team, is that we make sure that every week we have weekly debrief meetings with everybody that's involved in seeing all these different clients out on the street. So we can start really focusing on those folks that we see generating a lot of calls. Something there that some folks are calling like hotspot clients, frequent flyers. And that helps us in a lot of ways to be able to figure out who is utilizing a whole lot of services across town, who's getting 86 disallowed at different services around town because of their behaviors, and kind of tries to let us be kind of low-level case managers in a way where we can identify which people we need to help, talk as a team about how to more specifically help those individuals and get them to more appropriate levels of care. So if we see somebody that's really over-utilizing services at the ER, we'll talk about that individual a little bit and figure out some other plans and kind of make sure as a team we're on the same page so that we're not just repeating the same things over and over again that are not working already for that individual. This is a little bit about the breakdown of some of the calls that we're doing. At the top there is the numbers of assists. So again, that's where we're being called out to scenes where EPD or EMS went first, and kind of the numbers of calls and the average length of calls that will go just to help out and to kind of relieve EPD or EMS. And then the bottom there is the total calls that we're handling. If we take out the request for transport, which many things do come in as a request for transport, there could be mental health, substance abuse issues going on there, but we pulled even just those calls and a few others out and estimated that we were still, 7,865 calls. That represented roughly 4,560 hours that we were in service working with folks that law enforcement didn't have to be. Law enforcement / EMS. And, at the going rate right now in Eugene of $29 an hour for an officer, that's probably $132,000 a year. Then this is the ER.
There's another thing that interests me about the statistics, and I was looking also at the other slide about transports and where you're transporting people mm-hmm. to. It's pretty costly to send out an ambulance. You're an alternative to an ambulance. I don't know. I've never seen the inside of your van, except in the photograph, mm-hmm. of course. So I don't know what's in there. It's obviously not an ambulance. That has there been some sort of a calculation on what it would have cost if those persons had been transported to a hospital in an ambulance?
The hospital ambulance costs, it would be tricky just to know whether or not the ambulance would transport them. I think that's kind of where I'm going a little bit with the okay. CR diversion slide. Sorry. Of the number of folks we're keeping out. I think the real number that's hard to keep track of is preventative. Mm-hmm. That I can show the kinds of calls here that we think would have ended up probably at the ER and how many we kept from going there.
Okay.
62% of the calls that we went out on, a number basically that, up to like 1,800 calls in a year that would have otherwise probably ended up at the ED. But the preventative stuff we do where we go out and stabilize somebody who's calling 911 over and over again and need somebody to just go out and talk to them so they don't end up getting an ambulance or the police sent out there eventually. Getting somebody off the streets a little quicker because they're willing to call us because we're not law enforcement and let us take them to Buckley House so that they can sober up becomes like a huge preventative thing that we can't necessarily track. Just that number alone there of the amount, though, that we kept out of the ED, that number represents maybe 1.2 mil by 2013's average ER costs. And we, again, think it's way higher than that if you started including ambulance costs and the kind of preventative stuff that we do. And again, this is, I guess, where the tie-in to Buckley House is about how much we utilize their services and where it's also limited, but that we frequently utilize their services for folks that are would otherwise be heading to the ER because they're just not alert and oriented enough or seem like they're going to be a risk to themselves or others if we don't get them somewhere else.
Question?
Yes, Senator.
Can you say the word limited for a minute there? They are so limited?
Well, like I was saying about Buckley House, that they're set up for people that are on opiates, alcohol. The methamphetamine use that we've seen has skyrocketed, and that's difficult because there's only two secure rooms. And those two secure rooms, to put a finer point on where there's some gaps still in our area, those two secure rooms are also the only female beds for sobering. There is not a female wing because of funding at that place. So there's two beds, those two secure rooms. If they're both full, we don't have a place to take a female besides the ER.
So as a group, we try to meet people where they're at. We are client-centered, compassionate care model. We rely on our crisis counseling skills and de-escalation to get people to move forward, to change. And with that, we have to keep ourselves safe. We aren't armed like law enforcement. We do have police radio on our shoulder at all times. So when we need backup, we get it very quickly because we work with law enforcement and we're dispatched through the police department. They kind of have like a big brother, big sister kind of mentality with us, and the police are always looking out for us. The dispatchers are always looking out for us, and it makes a really great relationship and partnership. Police are always asking for a John unit. And again, with our client-centered model, we rely on empathy. We may not agree with what our clients are doing, but we can know that they're in discomfort and try and get them to a better space. And hopefully, when they are ready to make changes, they'll call upon us to get connected with services.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of those minor transports and things that we kind of see as minor, we see also as rapport building, and that we're helping somebody now so that they'll be more willing to call us for themselves or their friend down the road.
And for that reason, we carry blankets, we carry socks, we carry water, we carry healthy snacks. And again, we won't be dispatched for that, but once we're on scene, it can also help strengthen rapport and relationship.
So just some things that we don't do, and there's exceptions to every rule, but we don't restrain people or take them against their will. So from time to time, the police will say, you have to go to the hospital for a mental health evaluation, and you can go in the back of a patrol car in handcuffs, or you can go with Cahoots in the back of their van, which is much more comfortable. We don't take people home. However, there's no place for adolescents to detox, and if the parents are willing to take responsibility for them, we maybe will take them to the home to the parents. We don't violate client confidentiality, and that becomes kind of tricky because clients go through the non-emergency dispatchers, so we encourage people not to give their last name so that they can protect their confidentiality while still accessing our services. And we try not to judge people, to give people the best care and dignity that they deserve.
That's it. Any questions?
I'm sorry. Senator Bates.
Well, first, thanks for your work, and thanks for driving up here today. I've heard more about mental health, drug, and alcohol in the last hour and a half than I've heard all session. It's kind of what I thought was going on, but you've confirmed it. I don't think we have functioning systems. We have people doing the very best they can, limited resources, holes all over the place. We will have a mapping of mental health, drug, and alcohol available to us. It'll be a rudimentary map in a couple of weeks. And maybe we can start actually putting a system together that works. I had a little time with Whitebird a long time ago and was very impressed with their work. I worked for them at the country fair two times for two summers. It was quite an experience, to tell you the truth.
I can only imagine.
That's where the Cahoots model comes from. That's the crisis medic model that we kind of started.
That was back in the late 90s, early 2000. It was an eye-opener for me. I'm a physician, so I volunteered out there. It was interesting, but compassionate and serious problems. I thought your staff did a great job.
Thank you.
Really exciting stuff. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with all the sentiments for both of the groups that presented today. Also, one of those gaps that's kind of shocking to me is that there's no detox for adolescents. Is that just in the Eugene area, or is that?
I've worked statewide. As a crisis person at the hospital, and I have yet to find a location in Oregon that provides detox for adolescents.
Thank you.
thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you
and
for your time.
For providing your contact information for future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually I have some written materials here if you all would like.
Super.
Very, very good.
Thank you.
Good, good.
Any additional questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you for putting this together for us today. I know you did most of the work on it. This has been a great morning.
Really terrific. Really exciting.
I've learned more about the holes in our system today than I have all session. Thank you very much.
And ways to fill them.
You're welcome. We have some work to do.
Yeah. Thank you.
We're adjourned.
Quite possible.